Support for 51% comes from Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, Massachusetts, a community-owned natural grocery store dedicated to sustainable agriculture, the local economy, and the environment, working within the community to better Berkshire County one basket at a time. Berkshire.coop.
On this week's 51%, we meet the author of New Mom Comics.
These comics are really meant to be like a friend, you know, to tell you like the truth of how it really is with humor and love.
We learn about new legislation for paid family leave and hear about one of the women featured in the Oscar-nominated film Hidden Figures. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. You might have a mom, she might be the bomb, but ain't nobody got a mom like mine. Her love's till the end, she's my best friend. Ain't nobody got a mom like mine. She's my world, she's my heart. Becoming a mother for the first time is a transformative experience, a blend of worry and fear and comedy and joy. Many have tried to capture it in books, movies, TV shows, countless publications, and social forums. But one new mom thought the experience merited chronicling via a different medium, comics. Allison Wong is a product designer in San Francisco and author of New Mom Comics, The First Year, a collection of comic book-style panels and illustrations based on her experience as a first-time mom. A year's worth of lighthearted looks at phantom cries, blowouts, breastfeeding, and more. She recently spoke to 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall about how she crafted her comics and where she found her inspiration for them.
How did you get your start kind of as an artist?
You know, I've always drawn comics, even since I was a child. Growing up, I would draw for the newspaper, and, you know, I've always had an interest in design, and now I'm a product designer, and I still draw for that job currently. Even when I was in college, I drew a comic book for my thesis. So I've always tried to integrate illustration into what I do. The comic medium is really great because it's wonderful in communicating, you know, emotions and frustrations. And
now that dovetails pretty nicely, I'm sure, with your inspiration for portraying your first year of parenthood in a comic.
Yes, definitely. You know, there's a lot of books out there, a lot of parenting guides and blogs and articles, and I just felt that there wasn't a lot of visual, humorous comics really about the first year of parenting. And so when I got there, I was looking for such a thing, and I couldn't find it. So I thought I should start it myself. These comics are really meant to be like a friend, you know, to tell you like the truth of how it really is with humor and love. That you're not alone. You know, sometimes the books and things I was reading, I felt like I was wondering, oh, am I living up to the expectation? Is my kid behind? You know, all these things. And I just really hope that my comics help people just laugh a little, you know, that they have like a friend who's been there before.
How did you kind of come up with inspiration for the individual panels, individual situations?
Oh, it's all inspired by real life. You know, isn't that the best thing? Having a child, I feel like, is having this endless source of content. When he would do something funny or something that my husband and I would just do something ridiculous, I would jot, you know, a note down and draw and sketch out that scene. Like, sometimes it's just a nugget of an idea, right? Like shower cries. I always said these are phantom cries. And I would kind of think about how would this play out in a scene, a drawing, you know? And because my comics, I really try to incorporate a whole story in the drawing. It's not just like a three-panel kind of newspaper comic, you know, every day. I really try to kind of have a whole flow. You know, some of my comics don't even have panels. I do a lot of iteration, actually. I'll draw over and over again to get what I think is the funniest and right, you know, layout.
Do you do that digitally, or are you kind of old-school pen and paper?
Yeah, I do it all digitally now. You know, I used to draw a lot on pen and paper, but, you know, with the nature of just social media these days, and just, you know, as a parent, we're trying to find the most efficient way of doing things. And so I draw on an iPad, then import it into Photoshop on my laptop, and then I continue the drawing there, where I can put in some text, change things around. So it's really a lot of layers. So it's almost like using digital tools is easier for me, so I can kind of keep on drawing over and over again over the scene and then just easily erase if needed, and then I can post easily too.
And how long would you say this whole process takes to sort of churn out a single a single comic?
So, you know, I try to get a comic out once a week, and it usually takes me a few hours, sometimes longer, because sometimes I just let it sit for a while. I really have to think about that punchline. So I'll draw out the scene, and sometimes I don't have all the words there yet, and I just kind of let it linger. And then maybe like the fourth day, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good one, you know, and I'll try out a couple of different punchlines and even send it over to a few of my fellow mom friends. What do you think? Funny? Not so funny? But definitely within a week.
And how did you find the time to do it while balancing the care of, you know, a child under one?
You really don't have much time. And how I fit it in, about 3 months in, when my little boy was 3 months old, it was my first Mother's Day. It was May. I just had this thing where I wanted to draw something for other moms for Mother's Day. Or I wanted to kind of sum up my first 3 months, which is, you know, that first 3 months is such a haze. So I really spent a lot of time drawing this spread, and it was dedicated to, like, the superhero mom. Once I shared that, I got a lot of traction and a lot of shares and likes, and I felt like there was something there. And that's really what motivated me to keep going, because I knew there was just so much content. Like, I try to fit in during his naps. I got him on a relatively consistent schedule, and that hour, if I wasn't napping, you know, then I would sketch out some ideas. And I always felt like it would be such a gift to him and to other moms.
Now, obviously, you didn't have comics or something like this to sort of rely on for support. How did you kind of get through it all? What support did you have, or did you wish you had, as a new mom?
Good question. You know, the hospital I delivered at, I really appreciate what they did. They had a support group for new moms, and I went pretty regularly, and it was just the best thing. You know, as a new mom, you don't know what's normal or to be expected. And when I heard all these other moms talk about their daily struggles, I would be like, oh, yeah, that happens to me too. Oh, that too. And so I just got a lot of validation about my struggles. And almost like that gave me the confidence, actually, to when I was drawing my comics, that I knew that the content would be relatable to many other new moms. And so I felt like for those moms who didn't have a support group like I did, maybe this would help them realize that they weren't alone.
Do you see your content as specifically reaching out to moms, or is it also applicable to dads?
You know, I call the new mom comics just because it's from my perspective. But And I probably don't give my husband enough credit, but he's just the most wonderful dad, and I really tried to incorporate him into the comics. And you'll notice he's in quite a lot of them. And so I definitely think it's for all parents, because even the dads play such a big role, too. And so I try my best to just talk about parenting in general. You know, with all the worries and stuff, new moms and dads can both relate.
And by the same token, is there anything in your work that you feel to a woman? Is there something that you've put into your work that you feel specifically talks to them as well?
Yeah, I definitely think that the core audience is those new moms, from breastfeeding to all those physical changes that we go through. And so there are quite a few comics that just relate to those issues. And, you know, it's just something that men couldn't draw, you know, they wouldn't be able to convey. And I wouldn't even, you know, it's funny, as a new mom, like, I wouldn't be able to draw these until I was there, you know, until I actually experienced it myself. There's not very many women, I think, comic artists to have such a topic like being a new mom. I just felt like I had this opportunity, or just I felt like I had this responsibility, you know what I mean? Like, I really wanted to help other moms.
Are you going to keep going with it? Do you see this kind of going through toddlerhood or preschool or until he's 18?
Yeah, I would love to keep it up. It's like a daily diary, you know. I started off as like a visual diary, and I thought, you know, like, parenting is this journey, right? And you grow and your kids grow, and so I would hope that I can keep it up. And I'll probably have more worries and new issues, and it's a great way to reflect, you know, as a parent by drawing these comics.
What were some of the biggest surprises or lessons that you may have learned throughout this process, both of parenting and of chronicling your parenting?
In the first year, I felt like everything was so new, right? Like, there was a milestone every other week. He's turning two next week. I realized that I'm not so quick to worry. You know, I'm not so excited about, like, oh, that's a new milestone, because the milestones are kind of more subtle, right? But I think having this comic, it forces me to kind of reflect and think about the little things. and to realize that they are a big deal. And I really like that because it's so easy to overlook some of these things, right? Because you just get more comfortable with parenting.
I just want to go back to what you said earlier about women in comics. What are your observations sort of throughout your career, both in, you know, drawing comics and in your product design career? Are there as many women?
I was just, you know, anecdotally talking to some people, like, can you name a female comic artist? And I was thinking about all the comics out there, like even the ones about family, you know, whether it's Foxtrot or Family Circus or, anyway, there's just a lot of male comic artists. I feel like there's a lot of things out there, a lot of subjects that, you know, women have just a different perspective on, and if we could help illustrate this, it'd add a lot of perspective. I just think the comic medium is really visceral, and you know, there's a reason why, you know, the pictures are worth like 1,000 words, right? And if there were more women who would draw out their opinions and take to the comic medium, I think it would be so much more rich. And I think there are actually a lot of women comic artists. I don't want to discredit any of them.
The Jack Kirby's and Stan Lee's of the world kind of stand out a little bit more than, say, some of the female artists and creators, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I'm really trying to leverage just me being an artist and being able to convey such a female perspective, you know, of being a new mom. And I'd hope that helps other women. Yeah, it's so great to have that visual voice.
That was 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall speaking with Allison Wong, author of New Mom Comics, The First Year. Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro and New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand have announced the reintroduction of the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act. The Democrats say the legislation would create a universal gender-neutral paid family and medical leave program. 51%'s Dave Lucas has more.
DeLauro from Connecticut's 3rd House District and Gillibrand were joined on a conference call by business leaders, advocates, and reporters as they talked up the idea of a gender-neutral paid family and medical leave program. The pair originally introduced their bill in 2013. The Family Medical Leave Act, passed some 24 years ago, provides workers with access to 12 weeks of unpaid leave. DeLauro, cancer-free after 30 years, points out that only 40% of American workers have access to paid personal medical leave, and only 14% have access to paid family leave.
I was fortunate, but most working Americans are not. At some point in our working lives, nearly all of us need time off to deal with a serious illness or care for a newborn child.
DeLauro notes that although the Trump administration has expressed interest in paid maternity leave, she warns it would take the money from the already strapped unemployment system.
What the Family Act would do was to set up a national insurance program to provide participating workers with up to 12 weeks of paid leave per year for birth or adoption of a new child, recovery from a serious illness, or caring for a serious ill family member.
The paid leave program envisioned by DeLauro would apply to all workers, men and women. The average worker would pay $1.50 per week. Gillibrand says the vast majority of working families in America don't have access to any form of paid leave. A similar measure is pending in the Connecticut legislature.
We are the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't guarantee some form of paid leave. This means that when there's a medical emergency in a family, or a new baby's born, or an elderly parent gets sick, these families are stuck with an awful choice that no American family should have to make.
Gillibrand says that part of the solution to solving the problems affecting the middle class is paid leave.
Every day that goes by without a national paid leave program, workers will continue to lose income, they'll continue to lose their jobs, and businesses will continue to lose employees.
Deborah Ness, executive director of the National Partnership for Women and Families, says it is imperative paid leave be available for American workers.
We need it because of the changing demographics. We need it because it will make our economy stronger. And there are 4 states now that have paid family and medical leave programs, and more on the horizon.
Gillibrand and DeLauro say over 70% of Americans want a national paid leave plan. They're looking for supporters from the other side of the aisle and believe the White House is open to taking a long, hard look at their bill. For 51%, I'm Dave Lucas.
There is a group that opposes a paid federal family leave policy. The Right of Center Independent Women's Forum says universal paid leave mandates may have some unintended consequences, particularly for low-income women, by discouraging flexibility and leading to fewer job opportunities. Instead, IWF advocates for personal care accounts to help employees save money tax-free to cover sick or family leave. Businesses would be encouraged to contribute to these accounts in the same way that they contribute to employees' retirement savings, and lawmakers can provide tax breaks to businesses that contribute.
Girls and Bias. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is Science Update. Before their seventh birthday, girls already start believing the stereotype that boys are brainier, which could decrease their likelihood of pursuing fields like science and engineering. University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign researcher Lynn Behan and her colleagues report in Science magazine that five-year-old girls associate extreme smarts with females most of the time. But after they turn six, their views, along with their interests, have shifted.
We ask boys and girls if they would like to play a game for kids who are really, really smart. And girls became less interested in it compared to boys at the age of six and seven.
This despite doing better than boys in school. Behan says emphasizing hard work rather than raw genius could encourage more girls to stick with challenging subjects and benefit boys as well. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.
It's Black History Month, and we'll turn to a piece called Never Their Shame, which explores one of the most troubling legacies of the past for African Americans, the rape of black women by white men during slavery and the Jim Crow era of segregation.
This is Khali Blount, introducing Black History Matters. In this series, we take a fresh look at the persistent and powerful effects of slavery and the Jim Crow era on African American lives. In this segment of Black History Matters, we explore one of the most troubling legacies of the past for African Americans, the rape of black women by white men during slavery and the era of Jim Crow segregation. Retired history teacher Barbara Joyce Tabor Scott, Memphis, Tennessee.
The light-skinned blacks just did not occur out of the clear blue. It started on the plantation because if we were considered property, the master could do whatever he wanted to his property and no one said anything. And when you think about it, the two people who were hurt the most was probably the slave lady's husband and the master's wife.
Coleman Thompson, President, Pyramid Recovery Center, Memphis, Tennessee, on the lingering insecurity among black males as a result of sexual violence committed against black women.
It was okay for the slave master to, at any time they wanted to go impregnate an African-American female, and then this baby comes out to be brown, light brown. What type of devastation that had on that African-American male's mentality. I mean, you sitting there and a man takes your woman or your wife and just impregnate them or do whatever they want to do with them, and you can't say nothing. To me, that fear transferred, or that insecurity, or that emotional turmoil transferred from generation to generation to generation.
The presence of a mixed-race child posed psychological and emotional challenges for black families, especially the child's mother.
The thing about it is, being different from the majority of the people in her family, she perhaps had low self-esteem and didn't accept herself, because if anyone knew the truth, she knew the truth, and it could have been unbearable to her.
The rape of black women with impunity persisted well into the Jim Crow era. Paula Pennybaker, President and CEO, YWCA Southeast Wisconsin.
My mother never knew who her father was, but I suspect he was white, and I suspect she was a product of rape or in a forbidden affair. However she was conceived was an extreme source of shame to my mother. She looked very much like a white woman, and that was very painful for her all the days of her life. Her behavior was that of somebody who had shame in her DNA. And the sad thing about it, though, it's not her shame. It was never her shame, but she internalized that, and it created a very repressed person. Everything about her was about
protection. There's this secret, I am this secret that one must know.
For Miss Pennybaker, the origins of her mother's shame trace back to the rape of black girls and women during slave times.
That was a deliberate act of white slave owners from that time in our history. And that still is a problem in the black community today.
Black History Matters was produced by Robin Hood Radio, Sharon, Connecticut.
When NASA wanted to put a man on the moon, it turned to the brightest and whitest. That is, until Katherine Johnson demanded a role. Allison Quance explains.
Hidden Figures tells the story of three African-American women who worked at NASA during the height of the space race and in the Jim Crow South.
You have identification on?
We're just on our way to work at NASA, sir.
I had no idea they hired.
There are quite a few women working in the space program.
The movie is based on a book, also called Hidden Figures, written by a woman named Margot Lee Shetterly. Shetterly was born and raised in Hampton, Virginia. Her father spent his entire career as a scientist at NASA's Langley Research Center.
He worked with many of these women, so they were part of my community. I knew them, but I didn't know the story.
So she started doing research, and then she wrote a book. Now, thanks in part to Shetterly, the whole world knows the story of women like Katherine Johnson.
Katherine Johnson was somebody whose mathematical talent was apparent from the time she was born, really. I mean, she talks about earliest memories of counting stars and counting stairs and counting dishes.
In the early 1950s, Katherine was hired at Langley as a human computer, doing calculations and reading data. But the engineers were working on how to send a man into space, and Katherine wanted a bigger part in it.
She went to her bosses and essentially said, "You've got a problem to solve, and I am the right person to solve that problem."
And they agreed. So Katherine's role in the space program grew. She calculated the flight path for America's first human space mission. As they put it in the movie,
"You know, we're going to put a man in a can on top of a rocket and shoot him into space. Somebody's got to decide how to shoot him to space. Where do we put the rocket? How fast does the rocket go?" So that was the charge of Katherine Johnson and the engineers that she worked with.
Katherine Johnson and other black women mathematicians were doing this high-pressure work under the added stress and indignity of Jim Crow laws.
They are doing jobs that are sort of engineering dream jobs for smart people of every background. And yet, every time they have to go to the bathroom, they are required to go to a segregated bathroom. They are required to sit at a separate table in the lunchroom. And in the beginning, the black women were required to work in their own office, even though they were doing the same work. The law of the state of Virginia required this kind of segregation.
While the movie focuses on three black women in particular, Shetterly says that there were many more than that working at NASA during the space race.
From 1943 to 1980, taking into account not just Langley, but the other 10 NASA centers around the country, there were possibly as many as 80 black women doing this work, part of a cohort of women of all backgrounds that was several hundred, perhaps reaching as high as 1,000 women.
1,000 women.
And we're only just now really understanding the full impact of the work that those women did over the years.
As the movie hopes for Oscar wins later this month, the book continues to make its way around the world. It's already set to be translated into 17 different languages.
I have to say that my very favorite so far is in Italian, which is Il diritto di contare.
Translated to English, that means the right to count. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quance.
Job is for a man. Don't act like you was there when you wasn't. And the law of the land. The women were often banned. Don't act like you was there when you wasn't. I know they say they call for you all. But in my mind, I already chose.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1439.